Hi everyone, and welcome to Beverage Chronicles this week. I am Gary Monteroso, your host. Glad you can join us. My co-host Michelle Lamb is off this week. She'll be back real soon. Beverage Chronicles is a show that explores all different kinds of beverages. Beer, wine, cocktails, soda, coffee, anything. If you can drink it, we'll try and report about it. Our buddy Vince Douglas is going to be on a little bit later on. But first, I want to talk a little bit with you about collectibles. One person's junk is another's gold. If you ever held a yard sale or gone to a yard sale, you know this to be the case. And that's exactly what's happening with old beer bottles. What we call Brewerana has come to represent collectible items linked to beer, brewing, and breweries. This includes bottles and openers, ads, tap handles. Not only can these delightful pieces of history bring some flair to your home, but they can also wow your dinner party guests with fascinating tales from the past. The next time you're out at flea markets and garage sales, it's crucial to know what to keep an eye out for when searching for those hidden gems. From teal bottles that glimmer in the light to more robust stone pieces, beer hasn't always been sold in the type of glass you might recognize today. While finding a collectible bottle can be a bit of a challenge, seasoned collectors have their own tricks. The bottle's opening and shape, along with the type of closure used to seal it, we're talking about whether it's cork, a screw top, or crown, can give you hints about its age. The base of the bottle and the mold seams, which are the lines that run along the length of the bottle, can also offer clues to its age. Generally, the higher the seam goes, the newer the bottle is, while the most recent bottles won't show any seams in the glass at all. Here are a couple collectible bottle designs to watch for at the flea market. First, look for bottles that have markings on the bottom, because that can help you understand where the container has come from and how old it might be. They're called pontil marks. They are the scorchings left over from bottles that have been blown by a glassblower. And they usually mean that the design is from the beginning of the 19th century or before. Even further back, before the Civil War, a lot of the beer sold and made was transported in wooden barrels, where local taverns poured pints or bottled smaller batches in-house. Although it's safe to say that quite a bit of beer was gulped down in America before machines started pushing out bottles, these pontil dimple-shaped containers can be hard to come by. Bottles made during Prohibition, or just after this time, can be even more difficult to find. Once machines were used to make bottles, the bases became smoother, and different kinds of embossed markings could be printed on the glass. These two can indicate the value of what you find in the flea market. Now, beer bottles made before Prohibition often carry the words brewery or bottling printed on them, in addition to the name of the particular brewing company. These are raised markings, and they can appear on either side of the container where an actual label might be printed, or on the underside. They can be in any assortment of letters, words, or numbers, and even symbols, which often hold clues as to where and when the bottle was made. Hand-carved markings often weren't necessarily fully complete or would appear skewed when etched onto a bottle. If you notice a partial marking or something that looks like a mistake on these raised details, this kind of appearance could indicate an older beer bottle. Sometimes, if you're lucky, the embossed details will have an actual dated age of the container, so you know exactly when it was made and can make calculations about value from there. Another thing to look for is colored bottles, because they can indicate a more valuable bottle. Early Carl Conrad and Company Budweiser bottles can be light blue or teal, for example, and they've sold for more than $100 per piece. Other rare colors include amethyst and yellow. These unique hues are typically priced higher than glass bottles that are clear, black, and amber. Brown-looking glass designs were frequently used throughout the 16th and 19th centuries for storing more precious liquids. The shift began after we came to understand the kind of damage light can cause to certain concoctions. Manufacturers started extensively producing amber-colored glass in the 19th century. So if you pick up a beer bottle in this color, you can get a fairly accurate estimate of the age. I also want to look for embossed labels and shorter, stout bottles. Beer companies used to stamp their names on bottles because the early glass designs weren't exactly cheap to make. The embossed labels were used until around 1918 and helped each container get back to the right owner. Sometimes, though, bottles were confiscated by an enterprising bootlegger who would refill them with homemade concoctions. In addition to the embossed images and letters on the bottles, note the shape of the design to get an idea of how old it might be. Shorter, stout bottles that held porter and stout were used in the 1850s until a longer, taller shape was brought to breweries in the 1870s. As facilities looked to keep brewing and bottling processes efficient, different kinds of tops were used to seal the liquid inside. Now keep an eye out also for the lid, because the type of lid used can also help you determine the age of the bottle. The crown cap seal wasn't invented till the 1890s, and the blob top appeared on bottles made in the mid-19th century and throughout the middle of the 20th century. The term blob top is commonly used among collectors. Blob refers to the mouth of the bottle, as its surface will look somewhat rounded. And this kind of opening is a feature of models made from the mid-19th century to the early 20th century. So if you see this type of opening, you can assume it dates to sometime in this range. In the 19th century, samples became a thing, and there were smaller bottles that were labeled as such, and they could contain a dose of beer, bitters, or whiskey. Miniature bottles can be wonderful discoveries if you happen to find one tucked away on a shelf at the antique store. And the playful shapes can make a fun addition to a growing home collection. In addition to containing smaller amounts of alcohol, these tiny bottles were also used to pack poisonous substances. In this case, they were often made in colorful glass like blue or amber, and would have specific markings to indicate the hazardous materials inside. To differentiate between the sample beer bottle and one that could have been intended for poison, looked for embossed lines or points and the word poison along the glass. You also may see geometric designs that helped unknowing customers understand whatever was inside wasn't meant to be tasted. And another collectible are the old Pabst Blue Ribbon bottles. The history of Pabst can be traced to German immigrant Jacob Best, who opened the Jacob Best Brewing Company in Wisconsin in 1844. Its lager was the Best Select, and as product demand slowly increased, this became a family affair named P.H. Best & Company. Later, another immigrant by the name of Frederick Pabst arrived in America, married into the Best family, and in 1889, P.H. Best & Company was shortened to Pabst. The family continued to crank out beer, claiming awards and medals, and that prompted a rebranding of its Pabst Select beer to Pabst Blue Ribbon. This unique history means that bottles with Best Select and Pabst labels can become hot collector's items. Now, Pabst has an array of brewery, like bottle openers, displays, and cans. As with any memorabilia and collector's items, prices can range depending on the condition and age. Bottles without chips can cost as much as $20 online, while vintage ones can go for $10. For comparison, a rare 30-inch gimmick bottle made in 1950 can cost around $400, while a clear blue glass vintage bottle dating back to the early 1900s can be purchased for around $60. Another company you want to look for is Schmitz Brewery. They have a long history. They started in 1855 when it was called the Cave Brewery because the beer was prepared and stored in underground tunnels. By 1860, it had emerged as the largest beer operation in Minnesota. The company had a solid run of shipping its products across America until a restructuring occurred in 1898, and 2 years later, Jacob Schmitz purchased the business. Now, of course, during Prohibition, breweries took a hit, but Schmitz Brewery managed to keep beverages flowing by turning its attention to alcohol-free products. Once Prohibition ended, Schmidt moved into the position as one of the largest breweries in the United States. The brand's enduring history has collectors hungry for some of its various advertising gimmicks, like a Big Mouth beer bottle that can be found for around $15, or a 12-ounce design that can be sold for anywhere from $9 to close to $20. If a Schmidt's label catches your eye while digging through your neighbor's garage sale items, snap it up. Okay, now let's go to our buddy Vince Douglas, and he's going to do an interesting segment. For those of you who sometimes tend to cook with beer or whiskey or wine, his segment today is on how much time it really takes for alcohol to cook off in your beer. Okay, Vince.
From the classic combination of vodka and tomatoes creating a rich sauce, to the various methods of incorporating liquor into baked treats, alcohol goes beyond its role on bar shelves and finds a place in the kitchen. For instance, whiskey enhances the flavor of caramelized onions beautifully, while cooking with mezcal adds a bold smokiness, layers of complexity, and a Mexican flair to your dishes. Alcohol is also useful for deglazing a pan filled with flavorful fond, allowing these concentrated flavors to blend into the rest of the meal. We could continue to argue how spirits can elevate your cooking experiences, but using any form of alcohol raises an important question. How long does it take for the alcohol to completely evaporate? Not giving enough time for the alcohol to evaporate is a surefire way to ruin a dish. Preventing this disaster relies on how the alcohol is integrated into the recipe and the cooking technique used. For example, a study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture found that simply stirring alcohol into a hot liquid retains 85% of its alcohol content. Baking for 25 minutes without mixing it with other ingredients retains 45% alcohol. And simmering or baking a mixture with alcohol for 2 hours can still leave about 10% alcohol remaining. Therefore, the longer you cook, the more alcohol dissipates. While some residual ethanol may linger in the dish, when mixed with other meal components, it's unlikely to affect your senses. Pure unadulterated ethanol has a lower boiling point than water. If you were to heat pure ethanol to its boiling point, all the alcohol would evaporate. But who is actually cooking with pure ethanol? The wines and spirits we know in the culinary world contain additional elements, such as water and sugar, which complicate the process. As the concentration of ethanol decreases due to these components and other ingredients in the recipe, the interaction between the ethanol molecules becomes less straightforward. That said, if you want to minimize the alcohol levels in a final cooked dish, a few techniques can help with the task. One is to bring the boozy ingredient to a boil separately before adding it to the rest of the ingredients. Another is to cook a mixture containing alcohol with the lid on, as this increased the evaporation and resulted in a loss of ethanol. The general rule of thumb when cooking with alcohol is to cook with caution and eat responsibly. Of course, cooking with alcohol is not mandatory. You can always experiment with non-alcoholic spirits, wine, and beer. For Beverage Chronicles, I'm Vince Douglas.
Thanks again to our friend Vince Douglas for that report. Vince has done so much in his life. He was a bartender, he worked in a packaged goods store, and I know he's done quite a bit of cooking as well, so brings a broad focus to Beverage Chronicles. We appreciate having him. Personally, I have never cooked with beer or wine or any other type of spirit. In fact, for the safety and the benefit of my family and friends, I've really not done much cooking at all. I'm just not a good cook. I want to rely on the efforts of those who know what they're doing, including the great professional chefs. Okay, and that's it for this week's episode of Beverage Chronicles. I am Gary Monteroso. Remember, you can find more information about us on our website by going to beveragechronicles.com, and you can also check us out on social media. See you next week, everyone.